So I'll talk today about active learning by extraction of predictive information from a time series. So this morning when I drove here in my rental car, I was on the highway driving at pretty constant speed, and then I let go of the acceleration, and I'd been driving at constant speed for a while, and suddenly my car kicked in and kept the acceleration, the speed I'd been going in at before. But it doesn't have any button for like a cruise control. I hadn't turned on the cruise control. So maybe it has this like built-in function, right, where the car sort of learns what's the average speed you like to drive at, and so then, it just keeps that. So I thought that was pretty nifty. And obviously you can do that with a simple delay function or something. And so in a sense the car learned what speed I would like to drive at, right? But most learning tasks are obviously more difficult than that. First of all, you don't just have to learn a single task. And then you might like to act. So the car acted by giving me the gas, right? But you might like to act in a way that actually reflects something about your anticipation of the future. So if the car had done this to me while I was really close to another car, I probably wouldn't have liked it all that much, right? So there's a notion of you have to be predictive in what you're doing in order to survive and be successful in the world. And this holds true for probably most creatures, animals. So I want to look in an abstract way at this problem. So also many biologically inspired learning scenarios will be interactive. And there's not a whole lot of, not as much literature on active learning as there is on passive learning. So I want to tell you that what I'm presenting you here is totally work in progress. It's not finished work. So I'm doing this because I want to engage you in a discussion. And that's why I'm not presenting the stuff that I've already finished. Yeah? So it'll be, I'll just tell you how far we got, and it'll be open in the end, and I'll be happy if you interrupt me at any time and attack me. So this is work that we've been working on with Bill Bialek at Princeton for a while now. So let me draw for you the scenario that I'm going to be thinking about. So there's some world which outputs a stream of data, time series, so any signal. And at any moment, there's a learner that's able to sense the signal. And at any moment in time, I'm looking forward into the future for a certain length of time, and I'm looking backward into the past for a certain length of time. Doesn't necessarily have to be the same duration. So I'll call whatever happened in the past, x past, and whatever is going to happen in the future, x future. And the process by which the world generates this data will be given by the probability of seeing some data in the future will explicitly depend on some history and also on an action that the learner takes on the world. Okay, and so this is the probability with which the world produces a certain future. So this could be a parameterized model or not, and then W would denote the parameters. In addition to this, I also would like to keep an internal state in the learner. And this is we'll see later that we don't exactly need this. We could do everything just with an action, but then the action would contain also a model of the world that I have, and I want to pull these two things apart. So I want to pull apart what the learner learns into one part that interacts with the world and has an effect on the world, and another part that's just a model of the world that the learner has but has no effect on the actual world. So there will be an internal state. I call S, and this also changes as a function of time, so it gets updated by the learner. So at any point in time, the learner has the following problem. It has to choose, given a certain past, it has to choose an action and an internal state. And now,
does the action have an effect on the signal? Or?
Only through influencing what's going to happen in the future. So I've seen the signal, mm-hmm. right? Now I'm going to choose an action and also update my internal state. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to act on the world. And this will influence what the world is going to produce next. So it will influence what I see next. Okay?
I mean, perhaps the question is where would adaptation come?
Well, I'm trying to understand how learning works in such a system. So if you wish, I mean, what do you mean by adaptation? Do you mean learning?
Sort of, or? I come out from this room outside, it's really bright out there, so my pupil shrinks. Where would that be?
So that would be on the sensory side, you mean here, right? We change the way in which you sense the signal of the world?
Right, so that's the question. Is that S or is that A or is that X?
I'm looking at, well, that would be an action if you wish. So you could learn that action too. You could learn how you have to change the width of your pupil if
so
you go out in the sun. That would be A.
It happens to not interact much, affect the world probably too much.
It wouldn't affect the world, right?
It doesn't seem to affect the world.
But it will affect the amount of photons that you're going to receive on your retina, right?
It'll affect how the world affects you.
Right, so wouldn't that be S?
She says it's A.
Okay, A, fine. Yeah, no, I'm just asking.
But it's an important question. Is the human being also belong to the world, or it's separate?
Right.
It's a typical question of quantum mechanics,
yeah.
Observer and system. No, it's standard procedure, and it's not so simple.
But yeah. If you lowered the shade and made it darker in the room, that would act on the world, and that would be like, narrowing your pupils.
Yeah, there will be some equivalent. So I would say that any action that alters, you know, your observations, the way in which the observations are produced in the future, would be an action on the world. But I don't know. I mean, this is a very deep question. Am I part of the world or not? I don't want to look at the problem on that quantum mechanical level right now.
Quantum mechanical, general point of view.
I don't observer
and system.
Yeah.
So I want,
in order to get anywhere, I want to split up the problem into these. Into these layers, right? I want to say there is a learner, and there is some difference between the learner and the world, and it's interacting. So there's an output of the learner, which is the input to the world, and there's an output of the world, which is the input to the learner. So I have this recurrent.
Yeah, I think Nietzsche's point was though that there's an A that acts directly on the S. Because you can either change X. Or you can change the way you translate X into your knowledge of it.
Yeah.
And so there's a distinction that I think that means you're not even trying.
I understand. But
so neurons are the learner, and everything else is the world, I guess. So your interpretation is that the neuron, the brain, is the learner, and everything else is the world. Like pupil is the world. Like
maybe I'm having to ask. The question more precisely, what is the given in the problem? So what is the piece that doesn't depend on you? That's another.
Maybe we pass this question because in quantum mechanics people discuss this one.
Well, no, but in her model, not in general.
Maybe it helps if I just give some examples of where the scenario could make some sense. So It could be an animal or a robot in some environment. It could be a neuron in a network. So then the network would be the world, and the neuron would be the learner, and those would be the inputs that the neuron receives from the network, but it would be a recurrent network, and so there would be an output that the neuron also gives to the network. Does that make sense? And there's also a large, or reasonably large, literature on optimal experimental design, and so that's also one of the classes of these types of problems. So it could be, the learner could be a scientist analyzing an experiment and planning a new one. So then, obviously, this would be the data I've gathered from the last experiment, and I would be analyzing it, so I would make some kind of model of what I've seen and plan what question to ask next, so what experiment to do next.
Okay. Question, I mean, did I understand correctly that you said that the learner has a vision of the world?
A vision of the world?
Model of the world.
Yeah, so it's building up some.
It's building up
this internal state, whatever it is, and it'll.
But is this built just from the past experience, or is something more?
Yeah, this is just built from the past experience. So we'll come to this in a second. So.
Because in the last example, for example, it has.
There's a prior. Yeah.
Has knows the laws of physics.
Right. Right. So this.
Okay, it's not just the.
Right.
What you.
So let's say you're learning a parameterized model. Then at some point, you'll have to put in the prior over the parameters, in the equations that come out of this. So that's where your prior knowledge would come in.
So there is some prior knowledge.
Yeah.
It's not only.
Yeah. So another example would be just learning a functional relationship. So for example, estimating a distribution. And this is usually the problem that people treat in the active learning literature. So this would be query learning, where you want to learn some distribution, some input-output relationship, and your job is to choose the optimal input distribution so that you gain as much information as possible about the output or about the model that you can have of the world. So our idea differs a little bit from the way this has been treated, where we say, as I mentioned here, that we would like to construct this action. So we would like to find a rule for choosing an action and a state given the past. But so it's not only the past observation that I have to worry about, I also have to worry about my past state, or possibly states, depending on how long my record length is, how much memory I have, and my past actions, right? So I want to construct, I want to find this action state pair, and the idea here is to do it such that the predictive information is maximally kept. So we want to be maximally predictive about the future. So let me,
sometimes you don't know what the world is going to return, and in the experiment example, you want to do something completely novel, not having any idea of what you're going to get, and sometimes it's useful to, in some cases you choose an action that actually is very poor predictively. I mean, you have very poor.
Yeah, so the nice thing is that once I go through the math with you, you'll see that there are two terms, and one term drives you toward doing novel things, so choosing actions that will induce something novel, and the other term comes with a different sign and drives you to do that in a way that you can still summarize it.
I see.
So actually, if you formulate the problem this way, exactly this falls out, which is kind of the nice thing. So we'll just have to be a bit patient.
So what you're trying to do is to maximize the prediction about the future.
I'm trying to maximize the information about the future that's contained in my action state pair.
And how would you
answer? So I'll make this more precise.
Carlos's question, that if you want to maximize predictive information about the future, you just shoot yourself. You just shoot yourself, and then, you know, you can completely predict what happens to you, but
not to the world.
But not the world.
Well, how do you define?
Shooting yourself is a little bit dramatic, right? Another thing you could imagine you do that's a very boring state and makes the future very predictive is you always do the same thing, right? So you go into this catatonic movement, right? And you'll see in a minute that there's another term, a constraint, which prevents you from doing this, which is essentially that you're going to try not to keep any information about the past. Because if you drive the world into a state where it's just kind of in the limit cycle, then your actions and your state will also be very informative about the past. So if you're penalizing that, then you shouldn't get into these states. Never mind shooting yourself. I don't know.
Wouldn't you say also that if there's some kind of randomness in the world, so new things happen now and then, you would want to do things that are somewhat random, predict things that are somewhat random to explore those things?
Yeah, and you will.
That's my question.
And you totally will.
That was exactly my question.
So this is actually what's going to happen. So let me, you know, make this more precise for you and go through the math with you. So I think it probably helps before I write down the objective function to write things out in words. So I want to take the past and compress the past. So again, it doesn't just contain what I've seen, it also contains what I've done. Compress the past into an action state pair. Keeping as much predictive information, so information about the future, as I can. Sorry for the sound. So let me illustrate that on a simple example. So I said that the past and there's a certain memory. So my past will have some length, and the memory I keep about my own state will have some length, and the same for the memory I keep about my own action. So let's just look at a simple example where these are all one, and I've discretized time now. So I'm discretizing time, and I'm keeping only the last, so only the last thing I've seen, keeping only the last state I'm in, and keeping information only about the last action I've made. Yeah. You look like you're suffering. So then I'll have this time series of observations. Can everybody see this, or should I go up? This time series there will be my states and my actions. So what I propose to do here is to compress this, so everything I'm seeing at this point in time, to compress it into the next action and the next state that I'm going to make, that I'm going to keep. So compression means I'm going to minimize the information here. Yeah? And I want to do that such that I keep as much information about the future in this action state part pair as possible. So I want to maximize the predictive information. Now, you can write this down. Sorry.
Why is this sensible? Can you explain where this is? Why are you doing this?
Okay, there are two ways in which I can explain it. One way in which I can explain it is, this is all I have at this point, because this is the length of my memory. So this is all I know. So implicitly in this, there is a history of the past observations, because this got compressed into these guys, right? But so the history of the past is just kept implicitly in the state. And this is all I have right now, and what I have right now, I want to compress it into a new action and a new state. And this part here, that's kind of the proposal. I want to maximize...
Information. It's just a mapping, right? Just a mapping, or just what do you mean by compressing information?
What do I mean by compressing?
I see that you can map what you have, your memory, into a new action and a new state.
Yeah.
Why you call it the compression information?
Okay, so maybe I should make a little detour to...
Is that simple? Yeah. You have three numbers, and then you have to with two.
So you're losing... It's glossy compression, right? You're losing information. So these three numbers carry more information about the future than...
Because I would just think of that as mapping. Because if you give X, T, and S, T, a function would predict S, T.
Yes,
right, so here you're looking
from a space of larger dimension to space of smaller dimension.
He's right, it's not so nice to speak about compression of information. People who work in information theory would be very angry.
Well, I'm not saying I'm compressing information. I'm saying I want to compress, I want to find a compression of the current state, which is given by the future state and the future action. And that means that I'm going to minimize the information between the current memory I have and my future state.
But how do you do that?
Okay.
So in general, if I have some signal X and I want to compress it into some signal, I don't know, XC, some clusters, then how am I going to do this? I'm going to minimize the information between X and XC. I'm going to find an assignment rule of X's to clusters, right? So I'm going to minimize over the probability that X belongs to a certain cluster, minimize the information. But I'm not going to do this unconstrained, because then I'll just compress everything into one bit. Instead, I'm going to constrain this some Lagrange parameter here with, like, for example, the average distortion between X and the cluster center. This would be rate distortion theory, right? So This is why I'm saying I'm going to compress something, because I'm going to minimize the information between the current state and the future state. So I don't know why you didn't like the way I said this, but I hope that this makes it more bearable for you.
But what is it, Constantine? You call it to compress these three parameters into a set of two parameters?
So here the cardinality of the space of X. So cardinality of the space of X will be larger than the cardinality of the space of C in order to get any substantial compression, right? In order to get any substantial compression, right? Because on average you need like the entropy of this, which is, you know, if this would be maximum entropy, it would be the log of the number of things in this space. And only if you have like very few symbols here can you get a substantial compression, right? You understand that? So the average code length would be given by the entropy. So if I, instead of transmitting every single signal, every detail about this, any signal by itself, I'm going to assign signals to groups. And every group will have a representative template, if you wish. And this will be the XCs. And so I'll transmit them once, and then I'll just transmit the, you know, which group this signal belongs to. So I'll just transmit, you know, I have the signal, it belongs to group 2. Look up the template that you had of group 2. So if the number of groups, this cardinality here, is, you know, is much smaller than the cardinality of the original space, then I can get a substantial compression this way. Okay?
Is this just an example, or is that what, in general, you're saying is happening?
So this is rate distortion theory, and then the information bottleneck method is very related to rate distortion theory, and in some sense you could say that it's rate distortion theory just with a particular special distortion function. But the way it's phrased is very differently. So the way they phrased it is they say we have some signal X, let's say a newspaper, and we want to compress it again into some, you know, clusters, or in just into some representatives. And now we want to keep, we're interested in one particular thing in this data. So we're interested, let's say when we're reading the newspaper, we're just interested in the weather. So we only want to keep information about the weather in our compression and throw away all the other information that's there in the newspaper. So we have a relevant variable that we're interested in, some relevant variable. And they defined the relevant information simply to be the information that, you know, your compression will contain about the relevant variable. Okay? And so then they said, we want to compress, so we want to do the same thing as they do here in rate distortion theory. So again, we want to minimize the information here, right? But we want to maximally keep the relevant information. And then you have an objective function . When you take the functional derivative and compute the solution to this, you get this Gibbs distribution, which is actually also what you get here, right? So if you compute the solution here, you get that this will exponentially depend on the distortion. So the distortion is sort of sitting here like an energy term, which is why people like to identify this with the inverse temperature. So you have this trading off between an energy-like term and an entropy-like term. And the same happens here, but here you have a special distortion function which is given by the Kullback-Leibler divergence between the distribution of the relevant variable as induced by your sample, by your data, to the distribution of the relevant variable as induced by your cluster. So that means that, you know, if this is zero, if these two distributions are the same, then this data will be assigned to that cluster with probability one. So it means that data that induce similar distributions of the relevant variable will cluster together.
So in your case, the role of V is played by the future signal.
Yeah. So
actual
here.
Signal,
right. So okay. So in order to get to the solution, you had to make an assumption, which is that there is a Markov condition, so that the relevant variable is related to your clustering only through the data. So in other words, the probability of the relevant variable given the data and the clusters, if the data is given, because your input to this is actually the co-occurrence between the data and the relevant variable, if the data is given to you, then you know the distribution of the relevant variable. It doesn't matter how you partitioned your space. So this must be the same as that. So this assumption goes into the bottleneck, and here, when, as you noted, the relevant variable becomes the future, and so this now becomes the future observation, right? And this is my action state pair, and this is my past. So now the distribution of the future depends not only on the past, but as I said, also explicitly on the action, which is part of, you know, the representation I'm going to come up with. So therefore, I cannot make this assumption anymore. And so therefore, I have to generalize the bottleneck method to the case when this Markov condition doesn't hold. So that's one difference. Also, what you could do, well, maybe I shouldn't talk about that now.
I imagine you discretize time for convenience, right?
Just to draw you this picture.
Right, but so in reality, your left pink blob actually contains a whole window in the past, right? Or just one.
You mean this pink blob?
Yeah.
Would just contain, you know, the signal at any point in time. So let's just discretize time, and then we don't have to talk about this.
So the reason why I'm asking is that there's presumably some
continuity
in time,
yeah,
that has some scale in your,
yeah,
signal or many scales,
yeah,
and probably it wouldn't matter,
yeah,
how big of a window you take to minimize information. You get very different things if it's smaller or larger than that scale. Right?
Yeah. So, okay, so you're addressing this problem where, you know, you have this time series and
you also learn that, actually. I guess you could also learn that scale with experience.
Yeah, so you have this time series, and here's your future. And it has a length, t. And here's your past. And it has a length, t prime, right? And now, if you do the bottleneck method, what you would do is you would just compress this past into some state, which I called c before, right? Trying to predict something about the future. And then you have to ask yourself, well, how long of a vector do you want to keep here? And it'll actually very significantly influence the kind of clusters you come up here with. But what we're doing here is a little bit more general, right? Because we're keeping explicitly this internal state, which keeps a representation of the past before. So I can always, if I wish, just go to this case where I just look at the last point in time, the current point in time. What is my signal now? And then a history of what my signal was before will be contained in my internal state. So this is another way in which we're differing from just doing the bottleneck, keeping much predictive information. Okay, so now I write down the functional after all this. So as I said, we want to minimize over the possible assignment rules. The information that the action state pair will contain about the future signal. And under the constraint, we want to maximize this, right? We want to maximize the predictive information under the constraint that we minimize the information that the action state pair will contain about the past. And yes, you all know the definition of mutual information, right?
So it's not enough just to minimize the information contained in A and S.
Minimize the information that A contains about S?
Or just in this set. It's not enough. You need to compare it to the past.
This is what I'm doing, what I want to do. I want to take everything I have at the current time step, which are my pasts, and I want to summarize them with my action and my state. So I would say I want to compress them into my action and my state, but he doesn't want me to say that. So I will just take these pasts and construct an assignment rule. So find, the probability that I'm going to choose this action or this state given this past. So I'm going to construct this assignment rule from the past. And I want to construct it in such a way that my action and my state pair will tell me as much as possible about what I'm going to see next.
No, I know, but my question was a little bit different.
Okay.
Suppose you take a huge past, very, very long past, okay? Then you've seen more or less everything that you could see. So then minimizing the information between, the mutual information between your set A and S and your past would be more or less like, I guess, minimizing...
Okay, so you're asking about, what should the record length of these three things be, right? So what should the memory length be? So you're saying if the memory length here is really, really long, then I don't need to take this into account.
Right.
Yeah, okay, so I can take them out. But in the most general case, I'm going to want to take them into account.
I still don't understand something since we're talking in the most general case. I mean, I don't necessarily want to predict all of the future.
Right.
I want to predict only the part of the future that I care about.
Right, so here we're saying that you care about the entire signal, right? So you could also think that there is some signal that you're measuring, which is this x. But then this is actually a vector that contains some relevant part and some irrelevant part. And then you would only want to keep the information about the relevant part. So instead of saying x future here, then it would say a relevant part of x in the future. But formally, it would still be the same problem.
Then a bill should.
Okay, go ahead.
Why don't you want to minimize the information about the past? Why is it that you said you do want to minimize the information you extract from the past?
Yeah. So one thing I already mentioned is that if you don't have this constraint, then just to maximize the information about the future, you could go into a very boring state. You could push the world into this like oscillatory state. But if you did that, then your actions and your state would also be very informative about the past, because the world is always doing the same thing. So this constraint keeps you from falling into a trap like that. Or another way in which I can say why I want to minimize this information is because I want to take everything that I have right now and describe it with an action and a state. And the way I want to do this is by lossy compression. And lossy compression is just equivalent to minimizing the information between my representative and the data I have.
would not like to say that from general information theory point of view, people would say as you did, that minimized information about past. The expression that you wrote is just relative information. We have one random variable, another random variable, and we're just looking for this conditional information.
Yeah.
But people never say that they minimize information about past. It's not correct from point of view.
Is that true?
Yeah. You can think that you have limited memory resources.
Yeah, so where are the memory resources?
Yes, you have limited memory resources, so you cannot keep everything as you have.
So is that what it is? Is this a boss term for having memory resources? Is that what?
Well, the memory resource comes in here, like in what he asked the question. How long of a time trace do you keep here, right?
But not only oral
code. But you can say that you can code your action and your state with so many bits. Yes. And what if you're allowed fewer bits to code your action and your state, then the amount of information that's contained in this. Then you have to compress in a lossy way. And this is what happens here.
This is just conditional information. You have some information and then you want... People don't say minimize. I think it's not correct.
Is this true?
Yeah, it's...
People don't say minimize information.
Information is...
You can say whatever you want.
Okay, you can say what you want.
I don't...
I just know about terminology that is acceptable in information theory.
So is this true? Would you agree with that?
You can certainly minimize mutual information.
But she speaks not about minimization of mutual information, but about information about the past.
So that's fine. Yeah. She defined it. It's well defined term.
Of course, he can say it in whichever she wants.
When you keep objecting.
Yeah. I'm not against. But it's not in accordance with terminology used by others. You can open just any textbook in information theory and read it. It's a few just pages.
Well, come on.
Move on now.
Okay.
So just to wrap this up, so this is not about memory resources, but you really want to actively forget as much as possible.
Yeah, and keep only the...
You can cope with what lies ahead. So.
Mm-hmm.
But why?
But it is about, that's yeah, because that's of memory
resources. Yeah. So why do that?
Yeah.
Why would I keep everything?
because if you act in a way that's post-dictive, then you can... As I said before, drive the world into a very boring state, so you'll never see anything new. So if I did the problem without this constraint, right, then there would be, formally, if I just went through the equations, there would be no part that tells me that I have to choose my assignment such that,
Okay, so
I don't remember what I was going to say, the reason for this is if you act post-dictively, and if your state gives you more about, is post-dictive, then you will not be able to for example, look for new things. What will happen to you is exactly the thing that Ila said earlier, that you said with your shooting yourself problem, right?
And it was Carlos.
Okay, so you will fall into a state where you just create a world that is very repetitive. And that, pretty much takes care of maximizing this term. And there's no penalty for doing this, and so therefore you will not explore, you will not, act such that you see new things.
But that comes up as a consequence of your mathematics. But if one was to say, what motivated you ahead of time?
No, I think this is actually a motivation, because we thought about this problem, what if you get stuck in one of these infinite loops, how do you break out of it?
Independent motivation might just be that everybody thinks that you want to minimize the amount of information that of finite brain can hold.
That's another motivation. So another motivation would be to say, look at neurobiology. Your sensory data, you usually compress it, you throw away most of the information, and what you do and what you think is a huge abstraction of what you actually sense. And so therefore, it should be pretty natural to do something like that. So that would be another possible motivation. Yeah.
So what is his definition?
This is the definition of mutual information. Uh-huh. So it's the expected value of the, where is the chalk? The expected value of the log of the joint distribution divided by the margin of averaged over the joint distribution. And so what happens here is if these two random variables are independent, then this will be 1 and the log will be 0. So there is no information contained in the, that one variable gives you about the other variable. So this measures the interdependence of two random variables. The lower bound is 0. And it can only be a positive term.
You call it
and Shannon showed that this is like the only functional to measure information between two variables. It's called mutual information because it's symmetric, so that's why it's called mutual information.
What did you assume that makes you know that you could drive the world into an infinite loop?
Oh, because you want to be very predictive. So yeah, if you make the world boring, yeah, that's but one way
but
of.
But how can you do that?
Okay, you could, you could encounter a world that doesn't let you do that.
Yes.
Then the world gives you a constraint that prevents you from doing this. But we are just thinking, what if you encounter a world that does let you do this?
So that means
then you still don't want to do this in order to learn about the world.
It's kind of a strong assumption about the world.
No. It's actually getting rid of an assumption about the world. If I would assume that the world would not let me drive it into a boring, repetitive state, then I would make an assumption about the world. But I'm getting rid of this assumption and saying it could be possible.
To assume that you could always alter, that you only consider.
No, I'm not assuming. Okay, so I should rephrase it. I'm not assuming that I could always drive the world into a boring state. I'm just
like shooting yourself.
I'm just saying
that possibility in the state of worlds, there's one point where you can.
I'm just trying to motivate this term, right?
It's a state of measure zero.
No, I mean, look at autistic people. Yeah. This is what they do. They go into this catatonic.
But
for some time frame, they're left in this world by themselves. And then what they do with the world is they don't explore, they don't do something new, they do something catatonic.
Do you understand correctly that you are going to show that there are several regimes depending on what you do? Okay? Is that correct?
No.
That for example, you will find this solution. You stay in the same state. Then you say, okay, after all, there are very different regimes, the interesting regimes is.
Well, if you let T go to 0, then you go into the hard clustering case. But if you take this objective function, even for the t goes to 0 case, you're not going to get the boring answer.
I'm not seeing how an autistic is governing the world. I can see how they can perform the same behavior over and over again, but they're not controlling the world.
Let's say I give a child a set of toys that it can, like building blocks that it could build together. Uh-huh. Then for a limited amount, it has a lot of control over the world. So what is it going to do with this control?
Kids I've seen, they just bump their head on the crib or something.
So that's a catatonic movement. That's what I'm trying to say.
They're not controlling the world. That's just their behavior.
But it always gives them the same sensory input, right? If I repetitively bang my head against the wall, I always get the same sensory input. I know what's going to happen next moment.
In practice, is you're ignoring a lot of sensory input that you're getting.
Right. That's also true. But you also, by moving always in the same way, you'll set yourself up for also receiving very similar input.
So maybe one way you could perhaps, one possible answer to check is that you use this internal signal S to get rid of whatever
external signal comes, which is something new, and so the world that you see.
So I misunderstood what you were saying in the very beginning, because I thought X of T was what the world really did, and you didn't have control over that. You had control over part of it, but you couldn't control it completely because there are a lot of variables in the world you don't have control of.
Yeah. So what I said was that X of T is that part of the signal that the world produces that I am interested in.
But not necessarily control.
But not control.
And that the probability of seeing, the signal in seeing like a future signal depends explicitly on the history and also on the action I make at time t. So what the world will produce will depend on how I interact with it,
No, I understand the world is going to depend on how you interact with it, but it doesn't seem like it's the ideal model of the world where you can control by claiming that you're only interested in certain variables, that you have total control over those variables. That doesn't seem like the right model of the world to me.
Well, you don't have total control. There's a distribution by which what the world does can be described.
Yes, but if you don't have total control, then you can't necessarily say how you're going to get in one of these infinite loops.
No, but you can interact with the world in such a way that the coupled dynamical system that you and the world are could go onto an attractor.
See, I'm just not seeing that that's possible.
It seems very unlikely, right?
It is very unlikely, but look, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm not saying this is what I'm modeling. All I'm saying is I want to, motivate this term for you from all possible directions.
Yes.
So I think the most kind of natural way in which to motivate this term goes back to what Mark said before, is that this is what the nervous system seems to be doing. We seem to be making a lot of abstractions and throwing away a lot of information about, what we actually encounter in the world by building up what we think and by, building up what we're going to act. So that's one way of motivating it. And then this other statement was just trying to motivate it from a different angle. If I said, if I did this without this constraint,
He's not saying something very reasonable, right? Yeah. What she's saying is there's some degrees, right? The world consists of many variables. Some variables you have control over,
yes.
Some variables you don't.
Yes.
So if the subset of variables that you do have control over, if you keep repeating the same action on those ones,
yes,
in that small dimensional space of that subset of variables, you could go into a loop in those. The other ones are still continuing uninterrupted.
Just not my experience of the world. That's what I'm saying.
Well, if I'm sitting in a
room. My experience of the world is I can drive my car any way I want to. I can say, yeah, I'm going to just maybe the steering wheel go back and forth like that as long as I want to, but I can't. But I'm not going to be able to do that infinitely long.
Correct, but there are many situations.
I can't think of anything.
But for a given period of time, you could drive your car just in a circle, right?
Yeah, but you can't do it forever, but
you don't have to do it forever, right? Let's say you go into a parking lot or some new environment, and you're in your car, and you want to explore this environment, then the one thing that you want to avoid doing is driving in a circle.
Yeah.
But see, my I'm just saying that we should just go ahead and talk. This just doesn't coincide with my vision of this is not for me the kind of the model of the world that I would want to be making.
But it's the model of the world that you're making,
and so you should do
it. Tell me the kind of model that you would want to be making instead. I would be interested.
How about goals? Goals, like surviving.
I don't have the pathological solution, right? Because I have this constraint.
I'm sorry?
I don't have the pathological solution because I have the constraint.
Yeah, but then it's not natural to have reward as something that you want.
Most of the learning literature,
reward, for example, a rat can do actually a very repellent thing if you have electric
shock. If it gets
shock,
reward, right.
It will do that.
Right. So here, right. So absolutely right.
Reward, then you think that's the best solution.
Right. So can I say something to that?
Yeah.
So you can think about learning in a sense that there's a set of tasks that you're learning, and for every task there's a certain reward associated with how well you learn the task. But I don't want to take that view. So in a sense, my reward is how predictive I can be. Right? My reward is how much I can tell you about the future, how good my predictions will be. And the reason why I choose to do this is because I think that one, I'm the lying thing in all of learning tasks is, and in all of biology, is that you always do better if you can predict the future.
Well, maybe you don't care sometimes.
Maybe sometimes you don't care, but on average, if you know what's going to happen in the future, you can do better.
In his retina, when he gets rewards, we'll just do the simple thing.
But you can rephrase that and say the rat is predicting which bin it should go to to get the reward, right? So that's a form of.
But there's also other words coming in. For example, like you know, visions, things they never care.
But
if you just cut the reward, I mean, I don't know if that's successful function for maximums.
I mean, given that there are so many in different disabilities where you can, you know, apply this and maybe you would want to like make your claim now and then so that what is it that
but just one thing is I think what Chuck was saying, what Mitya said before was critical to answer Chuck, because Mitya asked about adaptation. And if you think that S you can use your internal signal to adapt and modulate kind of this X that is coming in, you could also use it to suppress a lot of X. And if you suppress everything, then you just get a constant world in which you can go through these loops.
Okay, but this is not what's happening here, right?
In general, it's completely acceptable to have these loops. If you can suppress things...
No, but this is not what I'm doing here, right? The S doesn't change my perception of X. I haven't set up the problem that way. I've set up the problem in a way that I split what I'm doing into two things, where one thing is just internal, and it has the world doesn't care about it, and it doesn't change my perception of things. It's like the model that I make of the world, and the other thing is an action. So I could think about incorporating what he said earlier, that you know maybe there should be an action that actually interacts with the world, and maybe there should be another action that interacts with my perception. So in a sense, I've left perception and adaptation out of this picture, right? So if you think about motor control, then you know you always have to be predictive, right? Because, like, I don't know, if we play a game or something and I want to hit the ball, then I'm always going to move to the place where the ball is going to be in the future, right?
But so the thing is that the reward you want?
The reward. So I actively want to drop the notion of reward and see how far I can get with just looking at this general concept of wanting to predict the future.
Yeah, it's fine, but sometimes you might run into something peculiar. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No.
Two short questions. Mm. Question number one: T capital is what?
It's this Lagrangian. So the people like to identify this with the temperature parameter because the solution has a Gibbs.
It's just the
Lagrange. It's the Lagrange parameter, but when you solve these kinds of problems, then you see that the solution has the form of a Gibbs distribution, and therefore people like to identify this with the temperature of the system. But we don't have to do that. Why don't we just call it lambda?
Okay.
Okay.
In this definition of pi x and y, there is an averaging. Averaging over what? X and y.
Over the joint distribution.
Over x and y random variables.
Yes.
Then
right
if you average.
So if x and y are random variables and if they're discrete, then you would sum over x, sum over y, p of x.
But then left hand side should not depend on x and y. You sum over x and y. The right hand side, left hand side cannot depend on x and y.
What did you say?
No,
I just can't hear you. Can you speak louder?
You can use another symbol, capital X, capital Y.
Okay.
Just saying two variables, X
and
Y. Yeah. Sorry for sloppy notation. So then, well, X can assume any of the values that are contained in capital X. So this is the probability that it has the value x. Okay. Okay. So let's move on and see what happens when we solve this problem. So in this term, we'll have the distribution of the future given the action and the state, and we have to express this in terms of the distribution we have here, right? So maybe we should stay with discrete random variables, but could also be continuous in general. So what the world does doesn't depend at all on the internal state, right? It only depends on the last action. And then the history of actions will be incorporated in the state that the world is in. So I'm also going to keep a state for the world. Yeah? So. So as I said earlier, I have to keep this term in here, and I can't just cut it out like you would do in the bottleneck equations, right? So when I solve this problem, the solution is Z is a partition function. So I'll delete this. Is that okay? So the distribution will have this exponential form. And in the exponent, there will be these two terms. One is the Kullback-Leibler divergence. And so maybe maybe for you I should write down the definition of this divergence as well. Actually, I'm using the natural logarithms here. Otherwise, I would have factors. Okay. So there's the distance between the distribution of the future that the world is going to produce given the action I'm going to make, and on the other hand, the distribution of the futures that I think is going to happen given the action I make. So distribution of the futures given my internal state and the action. And then there's another term occurring with a different sign, which is the distance between the distribution of the future that the world is going to produce given my action and the average, and the distribution of the future. Okay, so now I'd like to interpret this, right? So an action and a state will be more probable when what is in these parentheses is smaller, right? Because it's e to the minus this. And as, why is this beta? I should have kept this lambda parameter, and then it would be 1 over lambda, okay? So as I let lambda go to 0, it becomes more clear that, you know, this term has to go to 0 as well for, in order for me to get e to the minus 0 to get 1, to get a contribution here. And then as I let lambda go to 0, actually, this distribution will become a delta function. There will be either, you know, states and actions will be assigned to pass with probability 1 or 0. So that's the hard clustering limit. In any case, I want to minimize this distance here, but I want to maximize, because of the different sign, this distance here. So let's look at the second one first. What does it mean? I want to maximize it. The only variable I control in this expression is the action. Great, blue and black. So I want to choose an action such that it induces a distribution of futures that is as far away from the average as possible. So this is the term that makes me do something new, makes me look for outliers, makes me look for new futures, things that I haven't seen before. Yeah? For untypical futures. And then, let's say, given I have made that action, then I want to choose my internal state to reflect the distribution that is actually going to be produced by the world. So in other words, I would like to make my internal state sufficient statistics for this distribution. Also, what this tells me is that I cannot act arbitrarily perturbatively on the world. I can only do it such that I can still minimize this distance, right? So this puts a bound on how large I can make this term, right? There's a balance, there's a trade-off. So we thought that this was a pretty nice interpretation of, and pretty sort of intuitive interpretation of this result. And
typical problem of statistical physics is there could be a huge number of minimum points of this function.
Oh, yeah.
For example, in spin glasses, it could
be
millions.
Yeah.
What you would do is all this.
Yeah, so you can. So since it bears so much similarity to the bottleneck equations, which also and the iterative algorithm that solves them is bears a lot of similarity to the Blahid-Arimoto algorithm, and so you can prove for both that they converge. So you will find a minimum, but you know you cannot. I don't think you can prove that this thing has a global minimum. So there will probably be degenerate minima. Or it might have a global minimum, but then you can't prove that the algorithm that solves the equation. So you will iteratively solve this equation and the one that I had deleted earlier, you know, that gives you P of XF given S and A. You'll iteratively solve these two equations, and I don't think you can guarantee that this iterative algorithm will go to the global optimum just by doing this. You'll have to do something more fancy, like simulated annealing or something like that.
Several questions. If one were extremely naive, so the second term does not depend on S, and only the first term depends on S. Okay. Then, in principle, you could make maybe determine A just by maximizing the second term, and then choose S independently.
What I mean? But the first term also depends. I see what you mean. But the first term also depends on A. So, I think I mentioned this in the beginning. You could, in principle, do without S. But then A would contain the sort of model that you have about the world, right? So I've phrased the problem this way because I wanted, in the end, to be able to make this, draw this distinction. I wanted to have it clear that there is this internal model that will give you something about, you know, like let's say sufficient statistics about the world, and there's this action. But even if you didn't have the internal state, you couldn't arbitrarily perturb the world maximizing this term. You would have to do it such that you also are able to minimize this term, right? So this constrains the.
So the thing, are you supposing that so the probability is known, that the probability of the feature, or so that that's what I'm, because you could say that you have a time sequence of feature events.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you have, at every time you will apply your algorithm.
Yeah.
Okay. You complete or. You could think that you have given the probability of the feature. gave you something. And that's, maybe you
your question is, So I think your question is, how do you accumulate the probability distribution of the futures, which is the input that goes into that? And that's a problem, right? Like with all these types of methods, you have to somehow estimate the distribution. So either you could let your agent roam around for a while and get some idea about the statistics of this world, or you could use a very strong prior. But presumably, as you learn this, you know, even if you had a prior to start with, or even if you did some sort of like null period in which you just acquired statistics just to build up this distribution, after the time when you start to learn this, you'll still continue to build up the distribution in this way, right? So your statistics will get better and better as you go along.
I'm having a hard time doing the functional derivative that you want to do for that in my head. But I'm remembering that a lot of times when you use Lagrangian multiplier terms, you have different multipliers on the two things.
But these two terms actually come out of this.
The two terms come out of the one.
They come out of this term. So if I do functional derivative for this term, it's pretty easy, right? I just get p of the past, and then log p of a and s given the past over p of a and s. So this is this will go on one side of the equation, and this will, you know, end up giving me the expression for this. And everything else that's on the other side of the equation comes from this term. So these two DKLs actually come out of this, and they come out of, you know, I could write them differently, right? There's a little bit of redundancy in here, right? Because I have, you know, this times log of this over this, and then I have minus this times log of this over that. So I could just write it both as this distribution times log of this over that, which is what you get out of doing this functional derivative. But then I just wrote it in this way to make clear that there are these two conflicting terms.
Like you might want to do the problem in a way that you would have a different parameter on those two distances. Because it seems like you'd want to formulate it so you could do that. Because you might want to have a case where you want to change the weight on those two things.
I don't think so. And maybe it'll help if we go through a simple example. Because, you know, I don't know about the time. It's like, well, it's 11:45. How long is a...
Well, it's customary to continue until
12:15 or something. Just can I ask a question of very qualitative nature? I don't understand what is dependent from what and what is coupled to what. So here, tell me if I'm wrong, x of t is fixed once and for all, the whole series in time, right?
No, it depends also on how you act.
So where does this coupling...
Okay.
Where do I see how your result depends on the nature of the coupling between a and x?
Like probability and the future.
Here, this is the probability of the future that you will observe, the future that the world will spit out for you, given your action.
And p of w is some function that you decide.
Pw is the distribution that describes the process that the world is undergoing.
So
it's unknown. This is what you would like to know, right?
And you assume you can pick an A that will make that probability be 1.
Hmm?
For some particular...
No. I'm saying that you can pick an A and an S.
No, but I mean, that's the model of the world you were making, which says that you can control the world definitely. So you were saying before that you could determine what X is always going to be.
No, I didn't say that.
I
the world is described by a probabilistic process.
Yeah, but I thought you said you
so it spits out futures with some probability.
But I thought you said you could control it always, so you always had one specific outcome. That was the autistic.
No, I totally didn't say that.
But then I'm not seeing what the model of the world.
Okay, so the world produces some observable in a probabilistic way.
And you can control that
Let me finish the sentence. So the probability of the
As far as I understand, she does not want to exclude the case where you could choose an A such that the probability is 1 and 0.
But I thought the motivation for having that second term there was to keep from having an infinite loop of doing things, which implies that you can choose an action that will give you always a completely determined result in the world.
Right.
Otherwise, you couldn't get in a loop like that unless your model of the world is one where you can always control the output, what the world is going to do.
Okay, why don't we just forget about this motivation, because it seems to cause more confusion than clarification.
Yeah.
So are you happy with the motivation Mark gave?
No, I haven't had a chance to think about it.
Okay. So in any case, I would like to, I would just like to recap so that you understand what my model of the world is.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So my model of the world is that the world is described by this process.
No, that's what I thought. Then you said you wanted to have that other term to keep from getting into an infinite loop, which implied that your model of the world was one in which you could determine definitely the outcome of any act.
No, I don't think so.
The motivation that she used for the second term was to keep from getting into an infinite loop.
Well,
that implies that her world is one in which you can choose an action where the output is, because otherwise you wouldn't need that second term.
Look, you can say that.
This is an example of infinite loop. Yeah. We're controlling our world, our
right.
stimulus.
And it's not perfect, right? You're not perfectly controlling what I'm going to say, but still.
Not even close.
Can I ask a second question? What is P of X there?
That's the distribution of the future. So that's integrated over all possible paths and all possible modes.
All possible action also, right? Because action also influences.
Yeah.
Yes. So you have to have that power, you have to know that? You have to do everything and then...
No. This is what you're building up. This is what goes back to his question. How do you get that? So you're going to have to estimate. You're going to have some estimate of the joint distribution of your pasts and your actions and states. So it's going to take you a while until you build up this distribution.
It's hard. It's a fire.
And it's not fixed. Yeah. It depends.
Also,
on
my action
changes. And changes.
Your action will change your words. So you have to experience everything. You have to do everything and see everything and just...
No, presumably, given what you have seen, you just take what you have seen as your best estimate of the distribution. And you hope that that's good enough. Yeah?
But theoretically, that's goes in there, right?
Yeah, theoretically, what goes in there as an input is a distribution, the joint distribution of actions, states, and pop and futures, right? This goes in as an input, and that's a problem. You have to somehow estimate this.
Yeah, I have to estimate.
So you can estimate it with all the different ways you know of how to estimate this distribution, right?
And that's not a problem unique to this her approach.
But this is a problem that you know I will have. If I use this approach.
Evasion methods, we always have to estimate a prior like that.
Yeah.
Is this a problem with everything then?
This is a problem. I agree with you.
If I go to Mars and I know nothing about it.
But it's the usual bias in analysis. You focus the a priori distribution and you proceed. It's standard.
Yeah.
It's standard problem.
Okay.
But it's
so. Okay, so. What do I want to do next?
Example.
So I have an example. So, you know, I also wanted to tell you that, but I think we've already discussed this. What would it be like if there was no state, and what would it be like if there was no action? So in particular, if there was no action, if there was just a state, so now I'm not interacting with the world at all, then I would just get back to the sort of bottleneck-like solution, right? Where this term would not depend on my cluster anymore at all, so I could draw it into the normalization, and I would just end up with this term, and there would just be this S here, and it would just tell me that S should that I should try and make S sufficient statistics of the distribution that describes the world, right? Okay, so as far as examples go, it's kind of hard to do anything analytical because of this recurrency, because you're going to have to, you know, calculate this distribution and that distribution to calculate that distribution, but to calculate these two, you have to know this distribution, right? So anyway, let's make a very simple zeroth order example, and I'm going to, let's see, how do I do this? I kind of want to keep the assignment rule there so you can look at it, so I'm just going to use this part. No, I'm going to delete everything. Okay. So let's say we want to learn a function, a parameterized model. So let's say we want to learn the functional relationship between some, so this is the variable that we're interested in, y, and it's given as a function of the action that we're taking and some parameters, w. And also there is some small Gaussian noise. So this is the unknown function that we would like to know. And since it's parameterized, what we're actually after is the parameters, right? So then we know that the distribution that describes the outcome will be Gaussian due to the noise. With the mean centered around y having this value, right? Okay? Now, what I want to compute.
What is the past and what is the future? What is the time series in this example?
There is none. So this is the back, going back to the very simple question that most active learning deals with of query learning. I'm learning a functional relationship and I'm allowed to ask questions.
F does not depend on y. F, the function f does not depend on y.
No.
And w is what?
The parameters. So I'm assuming that it's a parameterized model. Well, let me just write parameters. So this is really one of the simplest things I could possibly be wanting to learn. Yeah?
So if noise does not depend on A either, kappa does not depend on A?
Eta?
Eta, sorry.
No, it doesn't depend on A, so I'm just assuming
so
that...
it's just a number. All this F is just a number.
Huh?
All this function F of A and W is just a number.
Yeah, but it's noisy, right?
Random.
So it's like some random...
F is random as well, not only A.
Yeah.
Some F with some noise around it, okay? So this is A, or X if you wish. I just called it A because, you know, we had this action A before, and it's kind of the same thing. So my action here is just asking at a new point what will the Y value be here, right? And I'll see something that's centered around the function, but distributed in Gaussian way because of the noise. Okay. I really need to drink something. No, I'm fine. So, what I want to calculate, well, I have calculated for you the assignment rule that, so now the past are the A and Y pairs that I have seen before, right? So the past contains of all pairs A, I, where I is my ith measurement, and Y, I, that I've seen before this time, yeah? So given that, and there is no state, so I'm sorry about that. The assignment rule should be, well, proportional to these two divergences. So now I'm just writing them out with the new variables so that you can follow me, right? So on one hand, there's PW of Y given A and X past. And on the other hand, there's P of Y given A and S. I know why I dropped the internal state. I need the internal state because I'm going, this is the same thing as I did before. I want to, you know, make it such that the action is actually the query. So that's the thing I'm going to ask. But the internal state will later, I will show that this will just become the best estimate of the parameters, right? That's the whole point of this exercise. So I have to keep the internal state minus the distance between this distribution. Sorry, it doesn't.
Is the number of parameters fixed from the beginning?
For this simple example, yeah. Let's say this. Okay, so I need to calculate this object, which is I want to integrate over all possible parameters. And then multiply with the probability of the parameters given what I've seen already, right? And so now I'm going to make a whole lot of assumptions. Huge amounts of assumptions. So first of all, I'm going to assume that I can write this function. Oh God.
That assumption wasn't correct.
What? What?
That assumption wasn't correct.
Bring the shocker.
It's rough and choice, right?
I can write this function as the parameters, so it's a vector of parameters, huh? Times a vector of basis functions. And then I'm going to define W est as the best estimate of W. This is the best estimate of my parameters. Hmm? And I want to show that S will, that, you know, the S and the A that minimize this part here will be the S that minimizes that will be the best estimate of the parameters. This is one of the things I want to show. And quite obviously, I also want to show like if this makes any sense at all, then it should turn out that the best S and the best A should just, you know, optimally predict the future. So there, so I'm going to later make an assumption about that there's an average future, and this is what I want to predict.
Can I ask a question?
So,
if you just do square error regression, how do you compare with this? Is there a relation to that, or?
Yeah. So, for example, if you do linear predictive coding, what you would do is you would just use squared error, right? So, make linear combination of what you've seen and then maximize squared error, minimize squared error, right? So, in a sense, you could say maximizing the predictive information is a generalization of this, or another step, because it measures higher order correlations, right? So in a similar sense as, you know, ICA is a sort of a generalization of PCA, right?
But you haven't chosen a particular error function, or you haven't chosen...
This is just ask, what's the relationship between this and the square error? Is there any relationship, or just...
Yeah, I mean... Look, that squared error is, so this would be the squared error would just have, you know, the average future that you want to predict. I mean, this thing here, right, minus what your prediction of it is, and squared, and it would occur here if you did it in a rate distortion way, right? So if you set up the whole problem in a rate distortion way, choosing the squared error as a distortion function, then it will appear in the same place as this long expression appears here, but it'll just be this the one term minus the other squared, right? So it's a nice thing. So I'm going to assume that this distribution here, and the distribution of possible parameters given what I have seen is already very close to the best estimate. So I'm going to assume that this is a Gaussian distribution around the best estimate. So assume and of course, the best estimate depends on the past, right? So that when I integrate here, I actually obtain for this distribution, have I made this assumption? Since this is also a Gaussian, right, I will get a Gaussian out. But this one here, with a different variance and different mean, so this will be this distribution. Okay. So now, and the variance will be given by. So now, I can calculate the divergence between this and that if I make an assumption about this. So let me assume, again, in a Gaussian thing here, so let me assume that my estimate here is almost giving me out the future, right? So. And now I still have to calculate this term. So I will make also the same kind of assumption about the distribution of the future. I will say that the distribution of the future will be centered around some most probable future. So it will be proportional to
now. Out, right?
Yeah, I'm just making this assumption now to be able to do anything analytical, to see that if I do go to this very simple case and make all these strong assumptions, do I get out the thing that I'm expecting to get out?
Like a trivial, because it's a flat line really you're talking about.
What's a flat line I'm talking about?
Because if it's a straight line, your errors wouldn't be
allowed. What's a flat line or a straight line?
Is it a horizontal line versus...
What is a horizontal line?
Y versus A.
You're saying this function is a flat line?
Yeah.
No. This function could have a variety of shapes. This function is just...
But how can Y can be distributed Gaussianly around one number?
Well...
That depends on the strategy.
What?
Y bar.
If it's a horizontal line, then I can stand. It's Gaussian around one number, but if it's...
Y bar is a function of A, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Y bar is a function of A.
Yeah, but the value of Y wouldn't be Gaussian. Mm-hmm. That's very restrictive on the function you can talk about.
It is, and it's very restrictive, and the only reason why I'm doing this is because I want to calculate anything in this problem, right? So I agree, this is very restrictive, strong assumption.
Yeah.
But let's see what happens if we go through this. So then we can calculate everything that's in this box. So this distance measure, right? The thing that we want to minimize. Which, and I guess I should just delete everything and write this down. So everything that's in this box here, I will call it D. And it will become... With all these Gaussian assumptions, it'll be this expression. Can you see this? Plus constant terms. So constant meaning they don't depend on S or A. Now, as I said, I want to minimize this, right? Because that gives me the highest probability for A and S. So if I let lambda go to 0, then I can show that only the A and the S that are the argmin of this function will induce a probability 1. So there will be, this assignment rule will be a delta function. So there will be delta of A and A star, delta of S and S star. This is very easy to show. Okay, so we want to calculate what are the A's and S's that minimize this function. And so from taking the derivative with respect to S and setting it to 0, I get here that S should simply be WS. So that's nice. Right? That's what I was kind of hoping would happen. So I'm learning an internal state, which just becomes the best estimate of the parameters at any given time. And from setting this, the derivative with respect to A to 0, and also using this equation, I get that my prediction of the future, which of course is given by S times phi of A, right? Because I said that I would decompose F of A and W into W phi of A, right? So my estimate of the future is given by S phi of A, and this will just be centered around this average future, which I assumed so brutally, right?
Oh, no, it's so, not
So this is minus 2.
Any Gaussian random function, which can be random from anything, with a Gaussian distributed randomness.
Yeah, but still, the function you cannot describe.
That's not sure about.
So that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying necessarily this is
a sort of Gaussian function as a very different function.
Okay, so in the simple case, it seems to do the right thing.
Very nice from statistical point of view.
So now going back to one question asked earlier, DJ. So suppose my world variables x have a bunch of sensory inputs plus a set of rewards, right? And suppose I do a very good job of predicting most of the sensory variables and also predicting the rewards. But suppose my actions are such that I never claim those rewards. Right, so I can do a great job of predicting them, but I don't claim them. I don't take them. Right. So,
So I should make very clear that the notion of reward is not in this formulation explicitly.
Yes.
And we did that, I think, on purpose because, I mean, porn PDs use that, right? They use a reward signal, right? So this is not what we wanted to model. This is not what we wanted to understand. We didn't want to understand how can an animal maximize a reward. We wanted to understand how can an animal summarize the information it has, given, such that it will be most predictive about what's going to happen next.
Okay.
So reward is not in this picture.
Okay. So then, just to summarize, I'm saying that actually the formalism can be very useful even if you're a reward-seeking animal, because before you can seek the reward, you have to predict it.
I think so.
You can seek it, right?
I think so.
You have something behind, like a back system that's predicting reward.
Yeah. So you could think about how you want to incorporate reward in this formulation.
Yeah, this was my question.
Yeah.
Right? So how do you incorporate the two strategies? And so you're saying that you would use this to predict reward, and then you can have a different strategy that goes and harvests.
Right. So that's like another step. Uh-huh. Right? But you might want to think about doing that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Susan, it looks like you can go deeply in the analogy with statistical physics and start directly from phase space, Hamiltonian, and then you will come to the same formulas, but in more analytical way. So.
What do you mean exactly?
No, you can consider phase space, consider Hamiltonian on this space, and then you can get Gibbs distribution.
But then the Hamiltonian is just the objective function I wrote down. So it's mathematically equivalent. So it's just a matter of wording. You don't like me to say compressed.
Another remark concerning the question of Dmitry, which was not maybe answered here.
Oh.
It's interesting that in statistical physics there is such notion as phase transition.
Yeah.
And maybe such decisions which are according to phase transitions, it would be such acts that we could not describe.
Okay, so here the phase transitions come about as you change this temperature parameter, right?
Yeah.
So if you plot, so we have this extended functional here, right? Which is the predictive information, and it includes all these interactions, and it's very complicated. So let's step back to the original bottleneck formulation just to talk about the notion of phase transitions there. Just to remind you, the Lagrangian, if you wish, of the bottleneck method was minimize the information between. So we wanted to, find some representation of signals X into cluster C, keeping information about a relevant variable v. And so I want to minimize this term minus beta this. Right? So we want to keep as much relevant information as possible, but doing lossy compression. Now, the solution of this was of the form of the Gibbs distribution, where this here was the inverse temperature, and this Lagrange multiplier, and the energy term, turned out to be this DKL. Just to remind you, it was between the distribution of relevant variable induced by the datum and that induced by the summary of the data that I have, right? So now if I plot the amount of information I am keeping in my summary versus the relevant information I'm keeping in my summary, and let's say I normalize here so that this point here is 1, 1, yeah, then certainly want to be above this diagonal line, right? So if you draw out the curve, you get some curve that's in this upper half, right? And now the derivative of this curve is the temperature. Okay? So temperature changes as you go along this curve, starting at infinity here and going to zero there. So you're starting from very fuzzy clustering where everybody is assigned to one cluster, essentially, going to very hard solutions. And if you don't limit the number of clusters you allow, then at this point where you're keeping as much, you're just keeping everything, you're not compressing, right? So there will be one representative for each datum. So you see what happens along this line is that the effective number of clusters that you're using to describe this data goes up. And those are sort of phase transitions. So you would find that at critical temperatures, you would see clusters splitting, and there would be more and more and more clusters. And the partitioning of the space would break up into smaller and smaller partitions, right? And on the other hand, if you would keep the total number of clusters fixed, then at some point you would deviate from this curve and, you know, get onto somewhere, right? Let's say this would be with two clusters. With three clusters, you would deviate somewhere here and whatever, right? So what I wanted to say is that the phase transitions happen, I think, or have something to do with the effective number of representatives you use. So they have something to do with, you know, your phase space here in A and S, right? So how descriptive can you be in your model of the world, and how many different possible actions do you have?
I'm confused. Yeah. What phase transition is similar to K value different when what is here K value of the
boy? So can you rephrase your question?
I mean, phase transition for finite system, you never get a phase transition. Okay.
Yeah.
And you will limit the different boy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, right. Absolutely. So, you have to imagine that. Okay, so you're saying, yeah, so you have to imagine that you have infinite data, right, for this picture to hold, which in reality you don't have. So in reality, also, you're not really calculating this quantity. You're calculating an estimate of this quantity, and there will be an upward bias. So you always overestimate this. And so you might want to actually subtract that bias, and then you will see that, you know, the curve will have some maximum at some point for a real problem, right, for where you will have to estimate the distribution. So Bill and I have also done work on this, doing exactly this. But I just wanted to kind of say that I think you were asking me the question, are there different regimes in which I will use different strategies, and can I describe those by some phase transitions as I change this parameter? And I think what I wanted to say is, as I change this parameter, sort of the effective complexity of my description of the world will change. At least ideally. Well, thanks for your patience.